Thank you, Stephen Laptisipoon, for joining us tonight. Modern Connections was kind of a program that my predecessor, Nathan Green, started, and it was meant to be focused towards art making and education. And so along those themes, I thought it would be a really appropriate figure to bring in, someone who's been a great mentor and kind of which has evolved to a friendship I'm very thankful for. So tonight, I see a lot of artists and I see a lot of educators, friends, colleagues. Thank you for joining us this evening. A couple announcements. On November 15th, Tuesday evenings will resume with the final kind of lecture of the season with Lorna Simpson. It begins at 7 p.m., so I hope that you guys will be able to join us for that. Kind of coincides with the Focus exhibition, which will include some of her works. But for Modern Connections tonight, we are going to kind of shift the format of the program and kind of have a conversation tonight. So as I said, we'll be working with artist, curator, writer, educator, Stephen Laptisipoon. You have a very vast resume, and I'd like to kind of just give you excerpts from it so you can get a scope of his work and his practice. But I think the intent of tonight is for us to talk about art making, talk about education, pragmatism, and audience. So to some degree, we'll get through those points and hopefully provide something which is useful for you all, kind of in the creative culture of here and abroad. But Stephen, just highlight some of your education. Stephen received a BFA from the University of Texas at Austin in 1977, MFA from the School of Arts Institute in Chicago, 1979. From 86 to 89, he also studied at Northwestern University in the field of comparative literature and theory. I'd like to highlight a few recent and past solo exhibitions and installations. 2016, this is a current project right now up in Houston at Project Row Houses with Sally Glass in collaboration with, which makes it impossible to sing. Another current exhibition up is The Green Linnet at Pilot Projects in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Styles of Radical Will, Italian Sculpture, at Sector 2337, Chicago, Illinois. Coffee, Seasonal Fruit, Spaghetti, and Rope, which was at David Shelton Gallery in Houston, Texas. New Drawings at Conduit Gallery. Hi, Nancy. Dallas, Texas. In 2015, he had Takare, Non-Takare at the Nasher Sculpture Center. Conversation Number 1, Haint's Blues with Lauren Woods at 615 Bedford Street in Dallas, Texas. That was for the Art Walk West. Subject Matter, a two-person show with Cheryl Donegan at David Shelton Gallery in Houston. 7 at Conduit Gallery in Dallas, Texas. That goes back to 2015. The resume is vast with exhibitions. You guys can go through and find more of those if you'd like. Some of his curatorial projects, 2016, Paperweight at Conduit Gallery, Dallas, Texas. Temporary Collectives, a graduate student exhibition, 500 Singleton, Dallas. My Misfire, a group exhibition in Deep Ellum Windows back in 2013. Some of plays and performances and readings. I'll just name a few, but just know that he's active in that field as well of presentation. 2013, Dark Warehouse, video screening with Vincent Ramos, Actual Size Gallery, Los Angeles, California. The Failure of Modern Politics and Now, Literary Festival, Lake Forest College, Lake Forest, Illinois. And just highlight a few awards. 2015, he received the Dozier Travel Grant from the Dallas Museum of Art, Texas. 2013, he received the guest house residency in Los Angeles, California. 2012, he was a recipient of the Moss Chumley Award for the Meadows Museum in Dallas, Texas. And in 2008, he was a recipient of the Wynn Newhouse Foundation Award. I just kind of wanted to go through those things so you get a sense of his activity and some of those that weight will carry forward kind of in this conversation and slideshow that we have. So I'd like to go ahead and begin. We've kind of worked on this PowerPoint together. We've spent a good amount of time, a few months, kind of collaborating on ideas, different ways to kind of unpack a lot of the things that he cares about and things that I've been influenced by, the relationship that we've had together. A few things have been inserted and omitted kind of just in the last couple of days. But I would like to begin with this excerpt from a video that was actually produced from the Dallas Museum of Art for his Concentrations 56 exhibition there. John, if you could go ahead and play this video, I think it'll give a nice introduction.
This kind of notion that by doing something radical and revolutionary in the present, you're actually honoring the radical and revolutionary of the past. And there's, I feel like I do things that are unorthodox or unconventional sometimes, but I feel like the tradition of a certain kind of carrying on a certain past thing, it's just I'm trying to like reconstitute another tradition, which, you know, rather than the sort of normative conventional one that says that art, you know, was these 10 things that ended here, I'm trying to say, you know, no, the trajectory is, you know, I don't know, the Dieter wrote, you know, with the suitcase of rotting cheese and, you know, those other, that other sort of tradition of radicality. And that tradition I don't break with. I'm actually always happy when I have a conversation about what I do as an artist, but that it ends up being about food and wine and bread and cheesy music and traditions and what somebody's grandmother did and things like that. Because I feel like as rarefied and esoteric as a lot of the concerns of my work are, I want it to be about the sort of everydayness of, you know, just little pleasures of things like food and good coffee and olive oil and old cheese and things like that.
I think for any of you who've spent some time with Stephen, on one hand, some of the intellectual conversations you can get to about culture can go one direction, but I think that that little excerpt is true to some of the different anecdotes that you kind of bring into the conversation and how accessible you can be as a mentor and as a person, as an artist. So let me go through this. Now, as we go through this PowerPoint, some of these are prompts to get to a certain point or just kind of begin a conversation on a certain matter. But I've pulled a number of excerpts from texts that you've written throughout the years. And it's been really nice to kind of return to these. Because early on, when I first met you in graduate school, I thought there was a level of him resetting a lot of my perceptions about art making and being an artist. And
that was polite.
And as I've returned to some of these texts, they have kind of a new relevance to me, and there's kind of a current energy that I think I have and maybe many of us do, that it seems to resonate in different ways. So some of these will be sprinkled throughout the PowerPoint as we kind of go through this conversation. But I'd like to begin with this. I begin my own desire to make art with a burden. Even though my vision is impaired, I reject that burden. I'm open to the sense world of time. I feel responsible to do more than add to a sea of commodities and attractive pleasures. I feel responsible to my artistic forebears, my teachers, my community, and my students. My work as an artist is now the accumulated testimony of addressing a specific audience, listening to my body, and placing this work in the proper place. I'm a listener and a speaker. I speak through my history, my senses, and my duty to others. How's that sound? Does it still
feel? No, it's funny. I wrote that as part of a sort of a essay competition for artists who wanted to address certain aspects of responsibility in the world and sort of how they saw themselves in the present moment. And it's something that I've returned to now in different forms since I wrote it. So it's been
a pleasure. I write a lot to go with the work that I do. I'm kind of always writing something, and it helps me kind of, you know, get at what I'm trying to do. I don't really ever see a lot of the writing I do as something that's, you know, illustrates what the work is or explains it, but more just, I mean, it helps me loosen up where my ideas are going so that I can do the objects. I enjoy working in different fields and in different domains, but it's sort of like one thing kind of loosens up or allows the other things to happen easier, and the writing has always been true for that. I've been writing alongside the visual work from the beginning. So this text was very helpful to me. It seems very melancholy at the moment, but I all this sort of burden and responsibility. But yeah, it was an important text for me.
Yeah, the text is felt very supplemental a lot to the other practice or part of your practice. Ostrinony. I'm wondering if you could maybe talk.
Wanted to title our conversation with this reference. It's, you know, slightly obscure, and it's something that felt like appropriate for what I've been thinking about recently. It's a term that's about 100 years old that I ran into when I was doing the work in literary theory at Northwestern. I had the good fortune to spend a year or so studying with Saul Morrison, who has done a lot of work in Russian and just Soviet era literary criticism, Bakhtin and Shklovsky and Voloshinov and Vygotsky and those sort of types. And this is a term that is mostly associated with Viktor Shklovsky, who was a Russian formalist analyst, and it just basically means like defamiliarization or estrangement. And it's just something I find really important as I make my own work and in work that I find interesting and valuable. It's the work that unsettles your notion of what it is to be, to examining, you know, a work, what to sort of like, it's not something that can be enacted, and it's constantly shifting, so that defamiliarization at one moment might not be the same at different times, but it's more of a strategy, a device where art making is engaged in a sort of poetic activity. It's not something that is, again, discursive or explained. It's more trying to use art making as a way to show us the world anew by getting us out of our routines and our kind of habitual things where we just become routinized to whatever's going on. So it's, I felt like the term was appropriate, being that it's about 100 years old, and it's something that I advocate also, the sort of idea of defamiliarization and making the world strange so that it can seem actually closer to you, that it can feel actually more alive by making it seem odd and strange and alien. So,
it seems like some of the origins of the term kind of related to poetry and prose, and that the former would be more difficult.
Yeah,
difficult language.
I think that art should engage in the difficult, in not being easy to manage or take in. I think sometimes I don't know. I'm drawn to work and to art making activities that are, you know, kind of own their difficulty, that really want to be not acquiescent to something, not compliant, that kind of resist and refuse and, you know, maybe say no before they say yes, and are a little stubborn and difficult in that way.
Clarity is not a goal.
Yeah, certainty. Yeah,
certainty.
Yeah. but clarity isn't either. I think, you know, sometimes I think we're drawn to things, and that's, I think, one of the aspects of poetry is that I think that thinking and acting poetically is the reason we go back to works of art over and over again. I think when they're easily digested, I think they can be easily discarded. So I'm an advocate for the thing where that takes us to that poetic place where we're sort of constantly having to interpret, reinterpret, challenge our own interpretations and share them with others in that way. So it's what I think poetic language does, but it's also, I think, thinking poetically does it that way. So
I remember you spoke to some students in a class once and you looked at them and said that art is not supposed to make you happy.
Yeah, this is going to be one of those nights when Jesse reminds me of all these things I said. well, I don't think it is. I mean, I think that there's a lot of pleasure to be had in engaging with works of art and in constructing culture together in the ways that we do. And I think that could be pleasure in there. But yeah, I don't think it's art making is supposed to make you happy. I don't think it's I don't know that it should make you unhappy, but I think that it's that shouldn't be a goal, you know, to be just a pleasure machine, that kind of thing. So yeah, I'd probably still hold on to that one. So
it seems like through the term that it's a little bit more of a forceful generosity or something that's given to contemplators to consider.
I think that, you know, I mean, yeah, when you said generosity, I like that, because I do think that while art making isn't there to make somebody happy or to make, or there to, for that to be a necessary condition of receiving art, I do think there's a generosity to it, that there's a gift and a kind of reciprocity and a kind of, it may be an offering of unhappiness, but I think it is always embodying a kind of offering, a kind of exchange, a kind of gift, if you will. So.
And I would say that the title of some of the text I'm pulling from is called No! Exclamation mark, a statement. In the next slide, I'd like to read this too. The impact must be through the body itself. The works of art should inhabit the viewer's space, not as decoration or ornament, something there to be forgotten. Rather, it should act to agitate and disturb, rousing a sense of estrangement and alertness. The political emerges from the emotions, from the experience of loss and longing, a longing for a time and place of truth. Works of art can gild that truth by changing the experience of the everyday in such a way that viewers recognize their own complacency. The call for engagement is signaled in the force of the gentle disturbance within the frame. Audiences are used to attempts to shock or grab their attention with novelty and clever design. It is the work of the artist to engage in a subtle insinuation into the emotional life of the viewer in order to remake their sense of security. Viewers block themselves from overt messages exhorting them to act. They are too fatigued by the onslaught of consumable information. Artists must act subversively, altering audience expectations, resisting compromise, and avoiding the needs of the market.
I think the thing that I remember writing about in that time, and it's something I do return to a lot, and I think it's one of those things that, you know, as you were saying, initially about the series having to do with education and its place now. And I do think one of the things I observe is that I don't know if people think with their bodies in the way that I think sometimes it could be helpful. I think there's a lot of ways in which, I mean, I'm not anti a digital world or this and that, but I do think there's a way in which there's a sort of giving over to a kind of flatness, a screen life that the sort of like, you know, real stuff of stuff that's around us gets almost like it's in the way or something like that. And I do think there's something about making a place for what art objects can do as a reminder that we are, you know, sensate creatures and we're right in front of something, and sort of the way that we absorb and perceptually navigate through the world. And so I do think there's something about the kind of loss of some aspect of the body now that I think it's important to get back to, or to use art as a way to agitate that place.
That idea of getting back or returning to history to be critical of it. In the past, I've heard maybe use a more traumatic term or something, the idea of rescue, you know, and like these ideas of resistance that I think comes up in a lot of
your work.
Yeah, I do
think there's the kind of, you know, I mean, our bodies are sort of stuck in some sort of sense of time and you have to go through. But I think if we stay in that world, it allows us to feel time differently, feel the past differently, feel the instruction of the past. When I've said things about rescuing, I think there's a lot of times when we rush past and forgotten so many things. I think we live in a time when history is denigrated. Study of the past is kind of manipulated in a way to sort of, you know, it's been instrumentalized in a way that I think is sometimes done uncritically. And I think that it can be useful and valuable to kind of like feel time differently. And, you know, I think, you know, an emphasis on our body and the material world that's around us, I think, can help do that. And then the other thing, as far as the rescue aspect, I do think that there's something about, you know, I mean, I really do think that, again, in the way that I think art operates more in the land of emotions and poetry than it does in the land of explanation and fact, is such that I think that if we can use our cultural interchange to sort of sometimes stir up in us what we've lost, I think it can be something that can be the beginning of a call to action. You know, the kind of like, not a kind of drippy nostalgia for something that's gone, but something that where there is a genuine shared thing that might have been more valuable than what we have in the moment, and that can be the first moment when somebody wants to rescue that. And I think that works of culture can be engaged in that activity in a valuable way.
Do you feel kind of being exposed to new generations of kind of young creatives as an educator, like is some of this urge or need more amplified kind of in recent times, or is it kind of been a static?
Yeah. No, I do. I mean, I think it's a gift to be able to teach, share ideas. I think, you know, in art education, it's a special kind of gift, in that the classroom is not only a classroom, but it's a studio space. It's a working space. It has to be navigated and shared and negotiated between people in the same space with very different needs, urges, working methods. And so it's, I think, an interesting communal experience that's even more intense or special than just any other type of classroom. So I think in that way, it's really very special, and it's something that I get a lot of energy from. And yes, I absolutely. I mean, I do detect things that are probably wrong to draw too many conclusions on from, you know, whatever sample of people I meet. But I do sense that there's just a speed at which we have so many things thrown at us all the time that I do think sometimes some elements of historical events, our history, the past in general, are not paid attention to in ways that I think could be helpful. And I do think that as artists, we, you know, have a more of a you know, there's a lot more to carry, that we you know, need to honor the artists who made art before and sort of gave us permission and cleared the path. So I do think that not forgetting is very important. And I do think that there's just so much stuff that bombards any individual, and I think sometimes young people too, that it's just, it's hard to, you know, worry about something that's 100, 200, 300, 400 years. And I do think that's one of my missions, is to have some of those things not be lost entirely. So.
Shortly, I'm going to read a little excerpt from Writing Art Cinema, excuse me, 1988 to 2010, kind of a recent publication, maybe 3 years?
Yeah.
Published by Green Lantern Press out of Chicago. I'd like to start with this little excerpt. Laptisapone's texts describe a subject built from the detritus of late capital. Movies, photographs, toys, art, poetry, advertisement, music, cartoons, philosophy, entertainment, anything, please, God, anything, and so present and represent globalization's liminal borders as a constantly shifting subject. Though his writing of the subject borrows heavily from theories of becoming and the trace, his subject, in fact, has already and always will be becoming. Laptisapone's writing, rather than celebrating change as a constant, though there is certainly a bit of that within his work, locates the subject as already having experienced a transition into becoming. Laptisapone legitimizes the tragedy of the becoming subject as it begins to, or already did, ossify. With this realization comes certain pessimism. How does one do anything anymore? But Laptisapone's great achievement, and he may disagree with this, is that his writing shows us, in fact, a new type of movement, a new type of optimism. Laptisapone's writing suggests a more fit subject, one able to recede and hide within its own ossification. It wanders underneath and between his text on a situationist derive. This subject is not separate from its surface. It still picks pieces of trash and film off its jacket when it wakes in the morning, but it does not necessarily locate itself, unless fruitful to do so, within its surface. The subject becomes two-tiered, a shifting surface on top and another, more elusive, consciousness underneath. This weird subject is able to hide within itself, able to make its own transparency opaque, and think through a subjective unity, one based neither in the stodgy forms of the distant past nor the constant change of the avant-garde. By doing so, by making ourselves strange to ourselves, Laptisapone recreates the subject as an object to comprehend. I think sometimes does your work still?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's. I mean, one thing that I pick up from what Devin was writing was that just. I mean, that I do think is true, and I think is that there's a lot of fragmentary information. I'm drawn to things that are scraps and bits of other things, incomplete holes. Taking, you know, a kind of you know, piecing together bits of things that may not seem to go with each other, to kind of, again, rescue or make connections of things that might have been passed over, to show where there are connections that might you might not have thought about by the fact that they've been swept away, but then you sort of, you know, sort of digging around in the garbage to make things, is something I feel comfortable with.
You know, for those of you who maybe... Some of Stephen's work may include hairs from shaving or food scraps or a box which was out in the rain, which I think is being exhibited right now.
Yeah, it's in Devin's space right now, actually. Yeah.
Have you... Can you trace this back to his transdisciplinary research and like comfort and ambiguity have always been...
You know, it's funny when you say that. If I had to trace it back, I just realized that probably as much as anything else, I mean, I you know, you can talk about, you know, collage and bricolage and scraps and fragmentary and ruins and blah, blah, blah. But I also, I'm as I sit here, I'm thinking that probably a lot of it can be traced back to the fact that my mother's entire side of the family were all like collectors, and you know, from trading and engaging in sort of, you know, things that are could be legitimately called antiques to, you know, utter, you know, just trash, you know, been in there, but they like the trade of it. And I remember some of the things that, you know, when I would hang out with my grandfather and go to antique stores and flea markets and garage sales and things like that, one of the things I liked the most about things was just sometimes digging around and rooting around in some of the stuff that was just, you know, not even on the shelf, but it was like maybe under the table and like the box. And it was all the dust and all the crap and all of the kind of wear and tear on the objects. So I like things with a little age. I like things, you know, that I always have. I've always liked things that show the wear and tear of life and the rubbing down of human hands on things that have been used and all of that. And I've always been drawn to that. So as much as anything else that, you know, Devin nicely said about the detritus of Lake Capitol, I think there's also just a, I like old stuff, you know. I mean, I really do like things that have that mark of disintegration and war. But it's also the wear and tear, to me, is also the register of past lives, of places that humans have passed through, ghosts, in a way. So I think some of it is maybe an interest in a discussion about pastness and presentness and becoming and trace, but also some of it is just upbringing, you know? I mean, I think some of it you just, I think we have those things, and that's one of the things I do think is important, is to sort of trust those things about yourself, sort of know what you're drawn to and why those things that, you know, made you, you know, whoever you are.
Significant these are the things. One's personal
yeah,
life.
And trust those things. I think it's one of the things that, as I've gotten, you know, older, that I do trust it, that, you know, you keep coming back to the same things, you keep doing the same thing, and there are reasons. And those things that I think are, I'm just a believer in that, that that's what artists can and should do, is trust who they are, you know, as something that's legitimate and valuable. So.
But what if you're wrong?
Then it's a great folly, isn't it? You know, it's a fun folly, yeah. And that's the case, is that I think, you know, a lot of times we are very wrong, you know, but...
Well, as I said earlier, my first encounter with you was the very first class I took in graduate school, and you were there at UTA teaching an installation kind of class to a small, newly formed graduate program at the school, and over the... And having that relationship as being a student to you as a new mentor, as an educator, it's evolved, as I said, to a kind of friendship, but to some degree it's still something that I'm quite fond of, is that a little bit of that, there's still a residue of kind of maybe forever, maybe always being kind of a student, and having you in this mentorship is something that I very much appreciate and am thankful for. But over the years, and I see a lot of former Stephen students here, you know, there are some reoccurring kind of ancestors or cultural kind of figures which have been your mentors, you know, to some degree, whether through history or whether through a direct real relationship. And, you know, in the beginning, I mean, this doesn't mean that you like a lot of my work now, but in the beginning you really didn't like any of it. And then this may be
That's
just typical. Well, this may be just kind of typical to, you know, beginning a graduate program, and it seems like there might be a lot of built-up tension from being kind of an undergraduate study and lack of real criticality and critiques or something. But it was kind of a brutal experience to engage in graduate school, kind of right at the beginning. But along, it was kind of serendipitous to meet you in that state, and I kind of, when I look back on it, you were very agreeable to certain works if they had a kind of logic or practicality to them. And sometimes I think that the ideas were put too far in front of the work itself, and it didn't quite align with something that you could really participate with as far as kind of confirming it. Or,
well, you know, as the direction that we've taken this this evening, it's just I'm just thinking. I mean, I remember, you know, your work very well, and I remember all the many engagements we had, at the beginning, as well as now. I mean, I welcome every conversation we will have forever. But when you said a logic or a, I think to me, it's the case with a lot of. A lot of young artists have to account for themselves, and there's a sort of like, well, it's about all this, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, and it's, you know, it's like, well, maybe that's what you like, but what's in front of you is not that at all. And so I like a lot of the first encounters we have are really just trying to make a connection between sort of what you said you set out to do and then what you ended up doing. And I know that we're going to talk, you know, you made a reference to pragmatism, and I think that's one of the lessons or hallmarks of the American pragmatist tradition, is that rather than worrying about what an ideal is or what you're aiming for or whatever, it's like, what's in front of you? And I think that's something that I hope that I can bring to some art education circumstances, is just to sort of say, look at what's in front of you. You know, it's like, okay, well, you've got all these great ideas about blah, 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 but what's in front of you? And it's that material connection, it's that body connection, it's that sort of like physicality of things that I think is, you know, always, you know, most important. Just sort of like, what is the thing, you know? I will continue to stress that. I just think that's the only way that the work of art can function, is that, like, what is it? You know, what are you looking at? Rather than sort of like, well, you know, the sort of thing that everybody, you know, talks a good game, but is the thing doing that? That kind of thing. So
early classes with you, you spoke a lot about Nietzsche and then to Heidegger, and then to Derrida, and then just kind of recently in talking about this conversation, Richard Rorty kind of emerged, and similar to past experiences, you kind of introduced me to something and it starts a curiosity. But I've learned that he was kind of one of those ancestors or someone who influenced a lot of your thinking. And I've really appreciated kind of thinking about Rorty and a lot of the preparation and conversations we've had before this. There was a little excerpt, so maybe I could go ahead and show that now.
Okay, sure.
John, if you could go ahead and play this video, please.
The less certainty we have, the better, I think. And, you know, it would be best if all the general principles that we use to guide our actions were left open for discussion. Certainty is not a goal of intellectual life, or it shouldn't be.
So, but don't you need to reach a certainty, you know, sort of like, in order to act on something, you have to come to a determination?
You have to have the courage to act without certainty. Typically, we don't have certainty.
So what do we have? We have just probability, likelihood?
We make our practical decisions on the basis of experience, the people we've run into, the books we've read, everything in our past lives. We don't make them typically on the basis of principle, nor should we.
You know, two quick things. I really do think that, just 10 seconds ago, my memory's not that good to quote, but it's something like, we have to have the courage to act without certainty. I think in some way that's the definition of making art. It's just having the courage to act without certainty. While I don't think Rorty ever thought of himself as an art theorist or anybody would, whatever. But I find out so many things that he says are instructive both for the teaching of art, but also the making of art. When he said that, you know, that we make our decisions on the collection of our experiences, the people we've met, the things we've read, you know, that's how we justify what truth is. I think that's absolutely true, and it's absolutely true where we should be making art from. It should be something that comes from the accumulation of our experiences, the things we've read, the people we've run into, our families, our loved ones, our whatever. That should be what is the source for our work. It needs to have that authenticity of lived experience. And I think, you know, so I think when he says that, I think that's absolutely true. And I really do think that, you know, it's whatever, 30 seconds or 50 seconds, whatever, however long it is, but he says a lot there. When he also talks about how, you know, we don't, you know, it certainly shouldn't be the goal of intellectual life. And then he's talking about like an open field. It should be an open drift. It's not about getting an answer so that you can hold on to this answer and explains everything, and it's used as a weapon, and it's like, you know, I've got the answer now, I'm certain, it's this kind of thing. It's more about, as you said, the discussion, the open discussion, the drift of it through, the moving through. And I think that's absolutely the truth with art making as well. It needs to be an open pursuit. It needs to be one that allows the knock at the door to be equally, you know, worked into whatever the process is. You know, that's the unexpected part. You know, the things that we don't anticipate. If you've already worked out what the thing is before it's made, you know, what's the point? I mean, you have to be along for the journey. You have to be along for the ride. And that's what he talks about when you sort of be involved in an ongoing, open engagement, an open extension. You know, he sees both Nietzsche and Heidegger as his antecedents as well, and, you know, the sort of notion of the path that goes all the way through all of Heidegger's work, and then the notion, and he talks openly and a great deal about the way in which being involved in an active interpretation and conflict of interpretations that Nietzsche initiates is, you know, absolutely, you know, what American pragmatism is about, in the way in which it's, you know, we are faced with other interpretations of other interpretations, and that's what we really can know. We can't know other things. We can idealize certain things, but we can't know these other things. And like I say, even though it's a very short clip, I think I think it says a lot. And I really will reiterate, I think that you know, just sort of the courage to act without certainty is what artists do, you know.
Over the years, kind of 2008, I think, is the beginning of time spent together, there's been reoccurring figures. You know, I mean, the situation is international. That idea of the Dari, kind of, I think it links to some of those things that Rorty and you were talking about, being open. You know, you don't want to replace a conversation with facts, because that's kind of a closure, mm-hmm. to some degree. I'm wondering, maybe I'll cycle through, throw out a few names. Maybe you can give and see if you're finding those in them, or maybe how they're.
Well, again, yeah. I mean, the notion of the. The notion of drift and wandering and you know, that's embodied in the Derive is important to me, because again, it's not an aimlessness, it's not a whatever, it's being guided by interest, being guided by desire, being guided by the most of the times there was a Derive, it was a communal group thing too. So it's also guided by exchange, you know, with another. It's guided by conflict, It's guided by pursuits that maybe don't get somewhere, that maybe, you know, groups splinter off and do those things. But it's guided by a quest for keeping the questioning going, for keeping thinking going in a way that doesn't end. Rory talks a great deal about valuing activities that are edifying or productively thinking in that way. And it's just that it's not something that is all tied up and neat in a kind of beautiful set of ideas that are perfect and untouchable, but it's more things that ask the next question, that ask the next question, that productively leads to a discussion that interprets the next question that keeps going. And then that's what he would see as edifying, something that moves it through in that way, rather than a kind of construction of some sort of perfect model that you can't ever live up to. And I think those are valuable things both, I mean, for thinking, certainly, but also for art making. I mean, it's just, you know, that the pursuit should be open in that way. The pursuit should be one that surprises the maker as well as the audience. You know, that element of surprise and mystery and wandering and leading to something else is what keeps us returning to works of art.
Does it preserve kind of that aspect of it being a social act?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what makes it a social act, is that you know, it's that the work of art enters the world and is taken to new places over and over and over again by the construction of its context, how it's seen, its circumstances, the social fact, the things that surround it, and the way in which the work of art contributes to, engages, criticizes, unsettles, defamiliarizes the social environment that it's in. So.
Okay, I'll cycle through a few. You know, over the years, Yanis Kounellis has been someone that seem to have a great affinity for. I'd be wondering if you could share, if you'd like to share a few.
We told Michael it wouldn't be participatory, but we should make him say what the name of his. But it's, I think it's something like Yanis is a badass or something like that, or something like that. But you know, so I mean, I think that, you know, I'm drawn to a lot of artists who are continually and who get old and continuously remain a little bit unmanageable and difficult and provocative. Elliot Carter, you know, and Cunningham, both of them kept going into their 90s. And Kounellis is constantly coming up with things that, you know, provoke, challenge. His badassness has not subsided, so I'm drawn to that. But you know, by the same token, that's the other thing I wanted to say, is that one of the things I also like about Kounellis is I don't understand a lot of it. I don't often really know what's going on in ways that continually motivate and interest me. I think, you know, in the same way that you know, when Rorty talks about something being that certainty isn't the goal, I think sometimes understanding is also kind of overrated. And I think it's there as a sort of place where somebody says they, you know, it's like this safe spot. It's like you're on base for a minute. I understand this now. But I don't know that it's either really true or even all that valuable. I think sometimes both misunderstanding and mystery are far more productive than either certainty or understanding.
Some correspondence with
reality.
I mean,
explanation is like, you know, totally useless. And I think that, you know, as well as an illusion, you know. So I think that, you know, what one of the things I do like about Kounellis continually is that I really have to keep pondering and keep looking and being, and it doesn't resolve itself easily. It's slippery. It keeps
moving in and out. I think I know this and whatever, and I get the force of this thing, and then there's another whole layer that I have to think about in some other ways in that way. So it's not that my admiration for somebody like Kanellis is that it's like, you know, oh, well, I get what he does. I love it. It explains this. It tells me this. And it's reliable, constant, and helpful in that way. It's more, what now? Oh, no, really? You know, that's, and I think that's what, you know, you go back to. And I think even, again, works that are more, less unorthodox than his, I think that, you know, for all of us, you know, in museums we have, you know, things that we go back to old friends, to pieces that you've seen over and over again. And I think we go back to them because we don't understand them. I think we go back to them because we want something new from them, or they're offering something new, or it's refreshing all the time because it's, you know, like, oh, well, I got that thing now, but now I'm looking at this again, and I don't really get, you know. So, I think that's one of those things that I find to be a slightly problematic kind of place, understanding. I think a lot of times people will say they, quote, unquote, understand a painting. And I think really a lot of times what they actually mean is that they can recognize some of the things that are being depicted. But I don't know if that means that they understand it. I think that would take a more broader historical dimension. Sometimes people will give us something. I think there's an element of reading an audience in its broader context that would be demanded of something that would be called understanding. And so I think that, you know, I just think it's kind of a suspect, place.
I didn't anticipate that so much would be said off of Kanellis. So we'll cycle through a little bit, some works by Smithson. These are figures that maybe those of you who know Stephen or have been his students, you know, that...
Well, Smithson's always been important to me in just many ways. I mean, partly also just I think that he's unclassifiable, and he did so many different things between writing, making sculpture, movies, you know, being just kind of generally puckish.
I'll skip through Manzoni, Marcel Brutters, Bruce Nauman.
Yeah, Nauman actually was one of the first artists I saw when I was in. I remember a couple of catalogs I got when I was, you know, probably in like second year of undergraduate school, and saw, a couple of exhibition catalogs. Probably some of the, you know, at that time it was, you know, a long time ago. A lot of body things that I didn't really quite get, but I got I remember very much liking the tactility of the pieces, the materiality of them, the directness of them, the scale, the play of language that was happening in them, and the psychological states. But again, it was something I remember very well, that I remember being, what I was drawn to was the fact that I didn't really know what was going on in a reliable sense, let's say. You know, something, nothing resolved itself in ways that could be dismissed. It was, you know, sort of ongoing in its challenge. And I think that's, Nauman was very important to me early on. And again, I think it was also the play of language that I was very drawn to as well.
We'll go to the end of some of these, this block of images, but Donald Judd, I think maybe his ideas of space and installation, like I found there's a nice little quote, I think, that gets to his personality and ego in some interesting ways. An idea is quickly debased, often before the originator has time or money to continue it. In general, I think this has happened to all of my work. but especially to the use of the whole room, which is now called an installation, which basically I began. I mean, he acknowledges Lisitsky and Schwitters.
Yeah. Lisitsky and Schwitters.
But, I mean, I just go back to my first encounter with you and thinking about installation and kind of compositional space and invisible space. But I'd kind of, it had kind of a new weight with me when, you know, he has, art does not change in one line, but, or not from A to B to C, but from V to 5 to L. But I think somehow the ideas of installation and its encounter with real physical space and viewership to a certain degree, I think there's kind of an interesting maybe metaphor. It resonates differently. And for the sake of time, I'm going to...
Well, yeah, just the only thing I would say is that I did want to not get past to mention is that one of the things that I really do have always admired about Judd is that, you know, is the stubbornness in his work. And I think that there are a lot of times, I mean, as you said, you know, what if you're wrong? But I do think that sometimes artists, you know, that there can be a value in, you know, part of the courage to act without certainty is just the plain acting as if you're right, you know, as if you did invent installation. You know, and I do think that the other aspect of that is that, and what's important to me about installation art in general is just the way in which I think everything is, you know, I don't think it's productive to make a work that just sucks into itself and doesn't pay attention to all of everything that's around it and the ways in which the world is conditioning it all the time, as if it's, again, what Rorty would say is a Platonist ideal that can be universal and timeless and be taken anywhere, that it needs to be constantly acknowledging everything that's around it. And consequently, you know, that's where I think the force of something that's installation related comes, is that it's, you know, you sort of have to acknowledge the real world in that way. So I think that's one of the, you know, keys to that.
It seems like it really activates that idea that it is a social act, you know, on a number of different levels, from physical space to people encountering that. Well, maybe if we could use this, and this was kind of a little flowchart. It was developed some time ago, so it's definitely not updated to any degree, but I just think for a moment I'd like to shift it to your influence to me as an educator and a mentor, but something which was very unusual prior to ever meeting you was... So, thinking along those lines of installation being a social act and dealing with real space and people encounters, a lot of, you know, ideas and support that stemmed from relationships with you, from myself to Michael to Justin and Jeff and Luke and Sally and, you know, among others, to Pierre, you know, I mean, it's your education and influence, I think, it's just interesting to visualize it in this kind of tangible way, to kind of see how your influence, and a lot of this I'd like to move on to. For example, here's a screenshot from the blog page for Sustenance, that exhibition. And this was an exhibition that Stephen organized with Anne Lawrence, but in graduate school. And, you know, a lot of this came, I think Justin opened up a lot of doors with kind of real estate developers, and there was just a lot of real social interaction between people taking advantage of having relationships together in real time to work together and collaborate. But putting this exhibition together down in Trinity Groves, it's just the amount of people that are on it. I mean, the exhibitors range from Brian Fridge to Daryl Louster, Devin King, Francis Bagley, Irish, Jeff Zilm, myself, Mike, Lou Malazzi, others. And I kind of like this as a snapshot or a kind of metaphor to look at your reach and the way that you were very inclusive with organizing and putting people of different geographical kind of positions in the world, different generations, together to just do the work. And you know, there wasn't any overarching idea or theme to it. It was essentially kind of an invitation.
Looking back, I realized there was a little bit of an overarching theme, which was that at the beginning, the deal had to be that the first thing we'd say to somebody is, you have to be okay if your work gets stolen.
Oh.
So, or damaged. And you have to be able to come in and basically make the piece in a couple hours, because you ain't got no much time to do it. So there was a little bit.
I don't remember that. But the invitation really meant something. It was a marker for something that I would come to admire in you greatly at that point, but still to this very day, of just taking people and giving them a level of trust and providing them with some kind of opportunity to do and to trust themselves, to kind of go with their instinct, with some killer instinct, whatever you used to tell us to pay attention to. And even if you just kind of want to look at the evolution of that area of Dallas, or the kind of emergence of a lot of the warehouse exhibitions, kind of DIY culture within that zone, I really kind of appreciate when I return to this moment, and very grateful that I was a part of it. But I think there's something here. I think a lot of students that I work with, so much work is made to be presented in media, you know, in that simulated virtual state. And maybe, I don't know, maybe today more than a week ago or something, we can maybe acknowledge kind of an overestimation of the strength or the value or the power, significance of that as a space, and as a counter to real space and real relationships and work together in a physical kind of place rather than a virtual. And when I returned to this, it just made me see it in a different way. I mean, here's some of you maybe will not recognize this building now. I believe there's a Shepherd Ferry mural on it now.
Oh, it's the hamburger place.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's gone too. It is a hamburger place.
Yeah, it's absolutely, you know, sorry. Yeah.
And then even more recently, kind of still in that area for Art Walk West, another kind of invitation that came out of, you know, the blue to do something together. And this was a work, could you remind, what was the title of the exhibition with you and Lauren Woods?
Oh, our piece was called Conversation.
Conversation.
Space Blues.
So I don't know if any of you saw this, but Stephen and Lauren Woods, there was always, you know, when you talked about Arte Povera and something, there was like a weird dismantling of a hierarchy of materials or site or place to work with. And you know, and I see some of this in a site and the way that you used it and made it useful as a kind of support to broadcast or transmit these ideas and this act of writing. Just, you know, it's very performative in a certain level, but today I do think that there's a great relevance. And sometimes, you know, we've talked a little bit about art not being a profession, and maybe being supplemental to other things, but even that professional attitude maybe of exposure and not wanting to do things in a local environment because one might have been or become too saturated, or for some professional trajectory of practice, you know, to, I don't know, I'm just kind of reevaluating a little bit. And when I look to kind of this grassroots organization of working with people that you've known from your personal life, or, you know, the different spaces that it's been, to unite and to just make work.
A lot of the things I've done, both here in Chicago, they don't come from, often, I've done a lot of things that have been collaborative and a lot of things that have been just engaged with either groups of people or, you know, disparate, kind of throwing things together. And it's not, rarely has something been generated by having some kind of plan and then finding like a way to execute something. It's more just looking around and seeing who's close by and realizing, oh, that would be fun. So it's really not, you know, I mean, I think I really welcome and cherish those opportunities to introduce people to other people and make connections for other people. And you know, just see an opportunity and kind of, I don't know, just make it into something that maybe was unexpected. So, but yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, the beautiful part of being in an art community is knowing people and just making connections for people.
And, you know, maybe these ideas of there being a goal, if one looked at being an artist as a profession or a career, I mean, I'm not, maybe...
Yeah, I'm not, I don't think, I think that's, I think, you know, it's a... the more and more, you know, that I go on and make things and the older I get and the longer I do whatever, I just really don't think that, I think to be serious about making art demands the same level of concentration and application of oneself to, that you would get from any job you take seriously. But I don't think it's a job, I don't think it's a vocation, I don't think it's I really don't think it's should have the demands of a career, and I really don't think it's a profession. And I think that to be professional is misguided. But again, I'm, you know, we did, I may not be the best, I mean, okay, I don't think, you know, in the way that, that, you know, to return to Rorty's being pragmatic about something, or to be take a pragmatist position, it would be, how can it be the same as a job in that it is, its demands need to be open, unguided, drifting, and without certainty, and an investigation. I don't think, you know, you sign up for that in the way that other people have professions. So it's just on the face, I don't think it is a profession. But, again, getting back to the other thing is, I don't know that I can be trusted in that evaluation, in that we did say that one of the artists I greatly admired the most is a person who, you know, had a bunch of horses turn around and leave their, you know, refuse in the middle of the gallery floor, and so I don't know where you sign up for that for a profession, but that might be fine.
No, we have so much cultural permission.
Yes.
John, if you could play this last Rorty video for us.
The idea is, I mean, the Greek idea is that at a certain point in the process of inquiry, you come to rest because you've reached the goal. And the pragmatists are saying, we haven't the slightest idea what it would be like to reach the goal. The idea that the aim of inquiry is, you know, conformity to correspondence to reality, or seeing the face of God, or substituting facts for interpretations, is one that we just can't make any use of. All we really know about is how to exchange justifications of our beliefs and desires with other human beings, and as far as we can see, that will be what human life will be like forever. So pragmatists regard the blatantist attempt to get away from time into eternity, or get away from conversation into certainty, as a product of an age of human history where life on Earth was so desperate and it seemed so unlikely that life could ever be better that people took refuge in another world. Mm-hmm. Pragmatism comes along with things like the French Revolution, industrial technology, all the things that made the 19th century believe in progress. When you think that the aim of life is to make things better for our descendants rather than to reach outside of history and time, it alters your sense of what philosophy is good for.
And this was an added thing, kind of a question that I have. I was going back and thinking of an old email that you sent, and maybe a misinterpretation I had for the metaphor, but kind of to begin a new semester at school, to the graduate class, I don't remember who was in it, but some email, maybe it was a poem, or maybe it was just the word, but Sassafras. And I remember at that point when I looked at it, I was thinking more, somehow the research led to, you know, Stonebreaker being, you know, this optimistic emergence, you know, a tremendous growth force and breaking through stone, you know, little plant. And kind of returning to it, different parts of the sassafras plant have been used to treat scurvy, skin sores, kidney problems, toothaches, rheumatism, swelling, menstrual disorders, sexually transmitted diseases, bronchitis, hypertension, and dysentery. So I guess, and then, you know, further, the relationship it has to kidney stones and the breaking down of that to allow passage or at least as much comfort as possible. Was that email more this or that?
As you said earlier, what if you're wrong? Two things. One, you mentioned earlier that you know, certain in the popular press many years, you know, people talk about most sort of notorious, you know, philosophy celebrity at the time, you know, in France certainly was Derrida, and people talked about the sort of corresponding way that Rorty was sort of a, you know, prankster in certain philosophical circles. And one thing they both had in common was a certain kind of level of unmasking and of showing you what you could and couldn't know. And I think that's involved in some of the things that's like is involved with defamiliarization. It's trying to unsettle your understanding of the world so that you can have to challenge what you do and don't know. And so it occurs to me that one of the lessons of great unmaskers is to sort of tell you that not only are there some things that you don't know, there are some things that you shouldn't know, there are some things that we're not supposed to know. And I think that, in fact, one of the things that art does best is place us in a world where we are happy, maybe, but we don't know. And that we are in a place where we are comfortably not knowing, if we are honestly receiving the work of art. And as far as what I wrote to you about in that email about sassafras, I really don't know.
We'll leave it at that. I know that we've gone a little bit over, but if anybody has any questions, we'd love to field a few from the audience. Okay, yes, please.
So you are certain that you are uncertain. That's no certainty.
No, I think it's an easy and a right kind of thing to take. It's more what, in the second clip, when Rorty says that there are certain things that he can't make any use of, it's not even whether or not I'm certain that I'm uncertain. It's just that I don't have any use for certainty. That's maybe a more appropriate way of saying it. Well, no. It's not, again, it's not confusion. It's not being bewildered. It's not whatever. It's that place when, you know, it's a little bit of what Jesse referred to at the end. He's talking about hierarchies. It's when you, and when he says something about substituting facts for interpretations. It's not so much, you know, being in a place where one might not have the use for certainty is not to say that you don't know something, that you can't be certain about what you trust and how you determine certain things. It's using certainty as a weapon, as an instrument for hierarchically saying that your facts are better than other facts. That's really what this level of uncertainty is. It's not just, oh, I don't know anything. It is, in fact, we do know things. He will say repeatedly, we do know these things. A lot of times, it's just, we don't have to, you know, it's like rather than going into vast calculations and elaborations of moral argument why something is right, a certain pragmatist position would just be, we know what's right. You know, I mean, we generally know these things by consensus. We've determined these things. And we will keep the open discussion to kind of maybe evolve the concept of right or wrong or moral positions. But for the moment, we kind of generally kind of center around something, and that's the most we can do right now. It's not that, whatever, it's just that that kind of level of feeling that he'll talk about, like, that's the best we can do right now. And that's something I feel comfortable with. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Lauren?
What emotional state are you in when you create your works? Because, you know, as an insight, there's a lot of people that don't do art a lot. I hear, oh, well, I can only write when I'm depressed, or I can only do this. So it's interesting to me because it kind of, you know, as an artist, your brain just kind of comes to it. Is there an emotional state that's more...
I don't think there's any consistency. I mean, I'm not at all like that, where, you know, I'm content and everything's great and I can make art now, or I only can make art when I'm depressed, or I'm this or that or that. It's just an activity. It's something that I...
Would you argue that makes you more of an artist than, or more of an insight? You know, I feel like that kind of makes you an artist, that it's a constant thing. It's not just this thing that you have to pull. But do you have a kind of an idea of why people would feel an emotion has to represent art?
You know, we were talking earlier, I mean, you know, there are people who've written, you know, Susan Sontag has a book, Under the Sign of Saturn, and Kristeva has her book about Saturnine, and there are people who talk, you know, various times about art temperaments and whatever. I don't know, I think, I don't know what can be gained from that. And I really think it would be, I think it would be,
I think that presumes having a lot more control, and probably.
I mean, is that something that is true for you?
It was at a time, yeah.
But what I'm saying is that even when you just say for a time, it means things change, and so I mean, I just don't think that anybody has consistency. Or if that's the case, then it seems more of a psychosis than a.
Yeah, it seems like a narrow-minded thing that once you've kind of opened your mind to how you make art and to emotion and things, you can control it versus...
I think art making is one of the most important and startlingly amazing things that can be, you know, that is offered to us as humans. On the other hand, I also think it's just doing something. You know? I mean, it's not that highfalutin, you know. And I remember one time actually, and this is probably something I'm not very proud of, but it's like I just sort of blurted out one time walking with somebody, and there was like a kind of street festival, and somebody was kind of plaintively, you know, pouring out their heart with a guitar and whatever, and they said, well, stop and listen to this. And I was like, no, I'm not interested in subjectivity. You know, so it's like, it just kind of burned up, and it's like this thing where somebody feels that they always do when they're depressed, or somebody has to, things, the expressive side is really something that happens afterwards. The expression gains, traction, the expressive side of things, whether it represents a kind of place of depression or whatever, blah, 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 you know, that happens after the work is made and enters the world. When somebody's feeling whatever they're feeling, I don't know, it's for them to feel. It's not a profession, it's not a job, but it is just an activity. We've probably talked to him. We don't want to cut anybody off, but also say you don't have to hang out longer.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.